An opening door throws a shaft of light into a stone tunnel.
Beneath the streets of modern-day Rome lies a network of interconnected tunnels that stretch for hundreds of kilometres.
These are Rome's catacombs. They're over 1,500 years old, and they contain many of Rome's ancient dead.
In 2003, deep within this subterranean labyrinth, a bricked-up tomb was discovered, unlike anything seen before in Rome.
Beside an area of half-exposed human skeletons, a man says, "I had never excavated a site with so many bodies. Quite unreal." A blonde-haired woman says the burials here are quite unlike the other burials in the rest of this funeral complex.
This was an ancient mass grave, piled high with thousands of skeletons. As a classical historian, I've studied burials across the Roman world, and I've never seen anything like this.
Who were these people? What did they die of? And why are they buried here in this extraordinary manner?
For the last 10 years, an international team have been trying to find out. Combining archaeology with cutting-edge science, they're looking for clues in the layout of the tomb, in personal possessions, and in the bones themselves.
Our aim is to try and understand who they were, so in some way bring them back to life.
Joining the archaeologists is one of the world's leading specialists in decoding ancient DNA. He's trying to find out how these people died.
This might be related to a catastrophe, to some kind of pandemic, to some kind of disease spreading.
A chance find. A tomb that confounds all expectations and multiple mass deaths.
This is the mystery of Rome's ex-tombs.
The Mystery of Rome's Ex-Tombs, presented by Dr. Michael Scott. Slim, dark-haired Michael walks along a busy Rome street.
Rome's catacombs have been explored and excavated for centuries, and by and large, their use, their layout, their architecture, fairly well understood. But then a chance discovery in one of these catacombs opened up a whole new mystery.
Michael approaches an unassuming door in a stone wall. Opening it, he throws light on some steps leading down into a tunnel.
This is the catacomb of St. Marcellinus and St. Peter. It was here in the summer of 2003. A burst water main caused the roof in one of the tunnels to collapse. The Vatican's inspector of catacombs in Rome, Raffaella Giuliani, was called in to investigate.
At first, I wasn't very surprised. This is something that happens quite often in catacombs. Then later, things changed. Leading Michael to a crumbling chamber wall bearing fragments of a coloured mural, Raffaella says, just above us is the place where the hole opened that started this whole adventure. One of the fragments shows a group of figures.
The first thing they found was the remains of a medieval fresco. The painting is believed to show the two 4th century patron saints of the catacomb, Marcellinus, a priest, and Peter, an exorcist. They appear to be standing guard over a burial chamber.
When we find early medieval frescoes in catacombs, they're usually connected to the presence of a martyr's tomb.
But nothing could have prepared Raffaella for what lay hidden behind the fresco.
We found these spaces almost entirely full of skeletons piled on top of each other. An excavated area.
They had uncovered a mass grave.
Raffaella says, in the career of a Christian archaeologist, this is a very prestigious and important find, and it was very exciting for me.
The burial site was located in an area of the Vatican's underground mapping system, labelled X. They came to be known as the X tombs. To find out if this was the last resting place of hundreds of Christian martyrs, the Vatican sought specialist help.
Each of the skeletons in the burial chamber has been labelled.
A team of French archaeologists were called in, led by Dominique Castex and Philippe Blanchard. Both are highly experienced in excavating ancient mass graves.
Michael and Dominique explore the warren of tunnels. At the end of one of them, Michael crouches down and points, saying, "And the opening is just here," to which Dominique replies, "Yes, just here." Below them is the chamber of skeletons. Michael asks, "What were your first impressions the first time you came here?" Dominique replies, "When I entered, I discovered a huge number of bones. There wasn't enough room to move, so we had to squeeze in." Dominique working on a partially uncovered skull, then a plan of the chambers.
As excavations began, six more chambers were uncovered, each piled high with bodies.
A 3D graphic.
The tombs were arranged on three separate levels, all located around a central hub.
We need to completely forget these modern walls here, which are actually working as foundations to stop the 6 metres or so of rock above our heads from collapsing on us. This is the crucial bit. This is the largest of the burial chambers. And the archaeologists estimate that there's just under a metre, about 80 centimetres left of compressed bodies still to excavate. There's another tomb there that was full of bodies that the archaeologists have now removed. And there's another one, two, three burial chambers behind us. So when we stand here, we are surrounded by chambers of mass death.
Michael shines a torch through an opening above his head, then an excavated area.
Picking their way through the bones, a few personal possessions came to light. A pair of earrings, a hairpin, and a small black ring. They also unearthed a few coins.
With Dominique.
The bones themselves revealed more clues.
Perched above the remains on a suspended scaffold frame, she says, you can see connected bones in some places. A graphic overlay points to the tibia, talus, fibula, and phalanges of an arm. Here you have a whole vertebral column with the pelvis continuing with the femur. The corpses were brought here and decomposed here. It was not just a case of throwing bodies in.
The fact the skeletons were still intact, with very little soil between the layers of bodies, suggests that large numbers were buried here at the same time.
Philippe tells Michael, they're all relatively well laid out on their stomachs or on their backs. The bodies were carefully laid out side by side, head to foot, and vice versa. To bury the maximum number of people in an extremely restricted space.
This has to have been something of a mass death moment, what archaeologists call a crisis event. Multiple people dying within a very short space of time.
But was this one single event or a sequence of events? To investigate further, the team made a detailed study of one of the tombs where all the bodies had been excavated and accounted for. By digitally restoring the flesh to the bones, a computer program was used to work out the original volume of the bodies.
Philippe tells Michael the volume of all the bodies exceeded the volume of the room. So that points to something important. The bodies cannot all have been laid out simultaneously. There just isn't enough space, says Michael. No, exactly, says Philippe. What's clear is the bodies must have been laid down at different times. The problem is, we don't know how many times and over what period, from the beginning to the end.
This study suggests these are the victims of a series of mass death events. Currently, the archaeologists estimate the tombs contain the bodies of around 2,500 people.
This is an incredibly unusual discovery. Tombs packed full of bodies layered on top of one another. You just don't expect to find this type of burial in a Roman catacomb.
Looking down into the burial chamber through a small opening, then Michael walking down a long, straight, tree-lined road in hazy sunshine.
I've studied the way the Romans buried their dead, and it's clear that they had great respect for their deceased.
Burial in Rome was governed by two guiding principles. The first was you couldn't be buried in the city, but the second was you didn't want to be buried too far from the city because you wanted your family to visit your tomb, but perhaps more importantly, you wanted to show off.
This is the ancient Via Appia, one of the main roads out of Rome. But every road outside the city walls would have been crammed with tombs like these.
It was Dionysius of Halicarnassus in the 1st century BC that said the endlessness of tombs on the roads leading out of Rome mirrored the endlessness of the Roman world itself.
The sun glinting on the roadstones.
But as the population of Rome expanded during the 2nd and 3rd centuries AD, the space available became increasingly limited.
Now, given the persistent desire amongst Romans to be buried in suburban soil, you can see how very quickly it became a pressing problem, what to do with the dead. And the solution, as far as the Romans were concerned, was to go underground.
In the catacombs.
Rome was built on a soft volcanic rock called tufa, which could be carved out by hand. These sprawling subterranean cemeteries grew rapidly under the city, but they look quite different to the ex-tombs.
Alcoves set into the walls.
Despite the fact that the corridors in a typical catacomb meander every which way, the layout of the dead was actually fairly regularized. You had your individual tombs called loculi, but I always refer to them as bunk beds. There's still the bones of one poor individual left there. And if you wanted something a bit more special, then you could have a cubicula, a bedroom for the entire family to be put to rest in. What was so good and so new about catacombs was their limitless potential for expansion and, as a result, inclusion, which made them really popular with communities, be it pagan, be it Jewish, or indeed, most importantly, with the increasing number of Christian communities in Rome during the 3rd and 4th centuries AD. And over time, as a result, they became a burial place not just for ordinary Christians, but for their saints, their popes, and their martyrs.
A human skull, then stacks of boxes containing excavated material.
As excavations continue, the bones from the ex-tombs are removed and kept in a makeshift storeroom for further analysis. So far, the French team have made a detailed study of around 500 bodies. They're starting to build up a picture of who these people were. From the pelvis bones, they can tell there is a mixture of men and women. The size and stage of development of the femur bones also gives an idea of their age when they died.
Dominique says, we have a right femur that would form a joint here, and the head is fully formed. There is no sign of fusing, so that means it's an adult femur. Are most of them adults? Asks Michael. There are a large quantity of bones which range from teenager to young adults.
These people certainly didn't die of old age. But are there any signs of trauma? If they were Christian martyrs or died a violent death, you'd expect to see evidence on the bones.
Out of 500 individuals, you would expect to find evidence of blows or injuries on the skeletons, which we do not have. Skeleton bones laid out like a body.
None of the bones show any signs of trauma that one would expect if someone had been crucified, or indeed if they died in battle in some sort of massacre.
So who were they? Why were they buried down here like this? And when did they die? One way to establish a possible date for the tombs and their occupants is to study the few personal belongings uncovered with them. The earrings were made from fine gold. They have a design that became popular in the 1st century AD.
They're smaller than a 1 euro coin.
The ring was found to be made of jet, a material Romans thought had magical powers. Studying its chemical composition, the archaeologists have concluded it came all the way from Whitby, North Yorkshire, in the 3rd century AD. Then there were the coins, possibly left as payment to enter the afterlife. Their age is much easier to establish. The oldest coin is of the 10th emperor, Titus, dating from AD 79 to 81. The wife of the emperor Antoninus Pius features on another, as does the emperor Marcus Aurelius, both dating from the 2nd century AD. The last coin was of Emperor Gordian. It's a rarer find than the others. He only reigned for 3 weeks in AD 238.
A worn, pitted, misshapen coin.
Coins are fantastic. They really help us narrow down a range. But there are caveats. You carry coins around in your pocket for a long time. They exist in circulation for ages. And the archaeological context here in which these coins were found are not secure.
The excavation pit.
To try and get a more accurate date for the bodies, the archaeologists wanted to test the bones using carbon dating. But this proved quite difficult.
Dominique explains the collagen which enables us to date bones was not always preserved. We carried out a number of dating tests and ended up with 10, which are fairly well distributed throughout the sections.
Carbon dating works by comparing the ratio of two forms of carbon, carbon-12 and carbon-14. When you die, any carbon-14 decays over time to become nitrogen, but the level of carbon-12 in your cells stays the same. Over time, the ratio between the two forms of carbon changes, and it's this that gives you the date. The breakthrough here is that the different chambers of the X-tombs came back with different results.
Highlighted chambers on a plan.
The bodies from the two larger chambers date from the 2nd and 3rd centuries AD. But some of the bodies from the smaller tombs appear to have died in the 1st century AD. These dates suggest the first burials took place here, possibly up to 200 years before work began on the surrounding catacomb of St. Marcellinus and St. Peter.
The fact that these tombs predate the catacombs that surround them raises the intriguing possibility that this could be the original core from which the catacombs later expanded outwards.
The red-earthed pit of bones. Dominique says perhaps everything started from this central area. Perhaps this site was discovered at a later date, which then could have been interpreted as a burial place of martyrs. From the subterranean chamber to cloud shadows passing over a Rome cityscape.
This is an exciting revelation. The X-Tombs could be among the oldest underground tombs found anywhere in Rome.
The dating provided by the coins and the bones and the other finds indicate that these people died between the end 1st century AD and the early part of the 3rd century AD. Now, that period of time in Roman history was, by all accounts, a golden age.
From the air, a large domed building and an amphitheatre.
Some of Rome's finest imperial buildings were completed at this time. The Colosseum. Great bath complexes. And ever larger public forums. The 18th century British historian Edward Gibbon described it as the period in the history of the world during which the condition of the human race was most happy and prosperous. The people of the X-Tombs were living at the centre of a vast and powerful empire.
At its height, the Roman Empire spanned 3 continents, 5 million square kilometres, and its territories stretched from North Africa, Egypt, the Middle East, Asia Minor, across Europe, and of course up to the border with Scotland. And at the very heart of it was Rome, Caput Mundi, as they called it, the capital of the world.
The city was a mixture of cultures and traditions with trade links that spanned the known world.
In the markets of Rome, you could find anything. Copper, gold, olive oil from Spain, cotton, wheat from Egypt, tin from Britain, iron from Germany, and more luxury products from further afield, like silks from China or gems, pearls, spices from India. Rome was a multicultural city, full of people and products from around the empire and beyond.
A panoramic view of Rome.
This was the world's first metropolis with a population of over 1 million souls. And the people of the X-Tombs lived and died in this cosmopolitan melting pot.
Rome's classical architecture and statuary to a modern building. Centre National de la Recherche Scientifique. Dominique lays out the bones of a human skeleton.
At their lab in Bordeaux, the French team are searching for more clues to the possible identity of these people.
Jagged teeth in a jawbone. From the University of Bordeaux,
Kevin Sales is analysing the chemical makeup of the bones and teeth in a process called isotopic analysis. This looks at the various atomic forms or isotopes of chemical elements like oxygen and carbon found in organic remains.
The minerals in your teeth are set when you're a young child and they don't change throughout your life, whereas your bones keep remodeling themselves, so they tell us about where you spent the last part of your life. And by comparing the two, we can find out whether these people were originally from Rome or whether they came from elsewhere and migrated to the city.
Explaining a chart projected onto a screen, Kevin says, here are the results from the teeth, and here you have the results from the bone samples. We have a community which stands out from the other populations that we are familiar with in Rome at the time. The bones tell us the last years of their lives. These individuals most likely moved from one region to another region, so this group is characterized by great mobility. But it is difficult at this stage to state more precisely from what region of Europe they came from. An almost complete human skeleton, including ribs and vertebrae.
In a second study, Kevin is able to explore what sort of foods they might have eaten. Their bones reveal a diet rich in meat and fish, more than found in other communities in Rome at that time. These people must have been fairly wealthy.
What's coming through very strongly in the archaeological analysis is that the people of the X-Tombs were not from Rome. They came to Rome, but where they were from initially, well, that's a question that the archaeology is still struggling with. There are some indications that it may have been Central Europe, but also from elsewhere. This doesn't seem to have been a homogeneous population, all from the same place. But they came to Rome, they lived in Rome,
and they died all together in Rome.
At work in the burial chamber,
the French team are starting to build a picture of who these people were and how they lived. But they also want to find out how they died. We know they weren't martyred. We know from the dating that bodies were deposited here possibly over a 200-year period. We also know they were carefully packed in, several layers deep at a time.
A stack of crates.
And that there was a series of separate mass burials.
Milling crowds, then a view of Rome's ancient buildings at night.
What the archaeology is showing is fascinating, that piles of bodies were put in these tombs on top of already partly decomposed bodies. So what we've got is waves of mass death. We know it wasn't massacres, so the best hypothesis for what could have caused this has to be disease.
A stone head flanked by two dolphins spurts water from its mouth.
Disease was rife in the capital, from tuberculosis to typhoid, leprosy to malaria. During the time of the ex-tombs, diseases like these are thought to have killed over 30,000 residents each year. Much of this was down to living conditions. Most of Rome's citizens lived in the world's first high-rise apartment blocks.
Ancient ruins.
They were called insulae, or islands, and there were thousands of them, densely packed into the city.
This is the Insula d'Aracelli. It dates from the 2nd century and would have stood at least five stories tall. Down there is the ancient Roman ground level. That's where the floor was, and the first levels are shops and inns, and then as you go up, you get the private apartments. But you know what? You wouldn't want to be in the penthouse here.
Michael explores the ruins.
The lower floors were rented to wealthy tenants. The upper levels were for the less well-off. The apartments were smaller, the number of people in each room increased, and living conditions were just awful.
The Roman writer Martial talks about a chap who had to run up 200 steps to get up to his apartment, and what could he expect when he got there? Well, not much. Cramped living conditions, dirty, probably a leaky roof, vermin. Families, groups of labourers all squeezed into these spaces. I mean, to call these places homes is overkill. They were a place to put your head down at night, and not a very pleasant one even then.
Michael's giant shadow passes across a high brick wall.
Aqueducts brought in fresh water, and the city had an impressive drainage system. But the people of Rome still lived in filth.
All rubbish basically just got shoved in the street, and then the public system of fountains washed it into the drains. But then, well, frankly, there's the poo. At its height, the population of Rome, it's estimated, was producing 50,000 kilograms of excrement a day. And none of these apartments were connected directly to the drains. You had to take your chamber pot and get rid of it. More likely as not, straight out the window.
Heading down steps to another level.
The people of the ex-tombs may have lived during Rome's golden age, but the streets of the capital were more like an open sewer. Disease raged through the city.
The remains of a fluted ceiling with decorative niches below.
And there was no escape, even at the famous baths.
A painting depicting semi-naked women.
The Romans loved their baths. It was a great place to relax, soak, have a massage, scrub down, chat with friends, or catch up on the gossip.
It was an incredibly important part of what it meant to be Roman. And it was a practice enjoyed by everyone from the emperor all the way down.
The people of the ex-tombs would have certainly gone to the baths. They were part of the social glue that bound all Romans together.
A worm-like bug slithers into a mortar hole in a brick wall.
The baths were attended by rich and poor, young and old, healthy and diseased. In fact, we know that Roman doctors actually prescribed a good soak in the baths for all sorts of ailments. So if you had everything from boils to rabies, from diarrhea to tuberculosis, you came to the baths.
Poor people who didn't have a slave to rub them down were encouraged to rub themselves against the walls. The Roman writer Pliny the Elder noted that scrapings taken from walls had warming properties. Long before antibiotics, these scrapings were prescribed in ointments to soothe sores and cure abscesses.
The sick and the healthy bathed together because the Romans simply had no real idea of how disease spread. The only thing that seems really to have bothered them is seeing the physical signs of disease. So if you had pus-filled boils or weeping sores, then they asked you to keep your clothes on while in the bath. Sometimes they just put all the lamps out. The baths really were the perfect place to catch a disease.
Michael gets up from a stone seat.
New strains of disease were constantly being brought into the city by traders, migrants, and soldiers. You can easily see how the people of the ex-tombs might have succumbed to waves of infection.
A team pull on white forensic suits and rubber gloves.
To try to find out what disease might have killed them, the French team have drafted in a world expert in reconstructing ancient DNA. Johannes Krauser is a professor of paleogenetics. His previous work was on the Black Death, which struck Europe in the 14th century, killing millions. By extracting DNA from bones from a mass gravesite in central London, he proved that the Black Death was caused by the bubonic plague.
A headline reads, "Black Death came from bugs in soil."
Here in the ex-tombs, he faces a greater challenge. The bones are much older. There may be very little DNA left behind from any disease-causing microbes or pathogens.
So what we want to have is the genetic material of the pathogen itself. So we're trying to find places in the skeleton that still might have the pathogen DNA to preserve. And what we have found is the best container for the genetic information are actually teeth.
How do you pick the particular teeth that you're going to work with?
We try to identify teeth that are still intact, that don't have a crack or some hole in the surface. And inside those teeth, we might have a little bit of dried blood where the pathogen DNA might still be present.
So we can actually see that the jaw is just sticking out here. You can actually see the teeth here being exposed, and it's just perfect to actually get in here.
Johannes carefully extracts a tooth from a jaw.
Yes, got it. Perfect. Look at that. Wow.
Oh my God, yes, you can see how wet that is as well.
That's a molar from the left lower jaw.
Right. Okay.
It's popped into a small clear plastic bag.
The teeth are photographed, catalogued, and bagged up, ready for transportation back to his lab in Germany.
Hopefully we have a little bit of the pathogen DNA that we can also get out of those teeth and then reconstruct the DNA, reconstruct the entire genome.
Johannes believes that some of the people here in the ex-tombs might have been killed by one of the most virulent epidemics ever to strike the Roman Empire.
A line of stone columns and the carved stone relief of a face.
This devastating disease was first recorded around AD 165, when the empire was ruled by two brothers.
It was called the Antonine Plague because of the family name of the two ruling emperor brothers, Marcus Aurelius and Lucius Verus. Now, the origins of this plague are shrouded in mystery, but there are reports that it emerged in the East, where in the early 160s AD, Lucius Verus was campaigning against the Parthians on the eastern frontier of the Roman Empire in what is today's Iran and Iraq.
Stone plinths engraved with Latin inscriptions.
A contemporary account from the pages of the Historia Augusta tells us a pestilent breeze arose in a temple of Apollo from a golden casket which a soldier had cut open, and it spread thence over Parthia and the whole world. The disease swept through the Roman army just at the time when the empire was challenged by invasions from the north.
In 168 AD, the emperor brothers came here to Aquileia in northern Italy. Now, Aquileia was a major trading center, but it was also a major military center. And it was to here that many of the Roman troops had been pulled back from the east. And it was from Aquileia that the emperors wanted to mount a campaign to push back invading tribes from the north that were threatening the Italian frontier. But when they got here, the emperors realized that the real problem wasn't the invading tribes. It was the plague.
Stone columns viewed from a low angle against a blue sky.
Army regiments would camp near towns and villages, and soldiers often returned home on leave. It wasn't long before the Antonine Plague passed into the civilian population.
A stone relief of a face with full lips, then another which catches Michael's particular attention depicts a broad-faced, bearded man.
The Roman Empire was a vast, integrated, connected trading network, which also contributed to the plague being able to spread so far, so quickly. It was in Italy, it was in parts of Central Europe, it was in the East, it was in Egypt. There's even one report that it made it as far as China. And of course, as the saying goes, all roads lead to Rome.
In time lapse, the shadows cast by columns start to converge. Dark clouds scud across Rome. The statue of a winged figure.
When the plague struck the capital, there was panic and public hysteria. Priests were summoned and religious rites performed to purify the city. The people of the ex-tombs would have been vulnerable just like everyone else. According to Roman consul and writer Dio Cassius, 2,000 people often died in Rome in a single day.
In his books, the emperor's physician Galen described some of the symptoms of the Antonine Plague: a fever, a rash, a diarrhea, foul-smelling feces, an ulceration of the windpipe, and dry pustular eruptions on the skin.
No one knows for sure what actual disease was responsible for the Antonine Plague. We do know it claimed more lives than any previously recorded epidemic. Across the empire, something like 5 million people were killed, up to a tenth of the entire Roman population. The plague struck in waves that lasted from AD 165 to 180, then again in 189.
A mosaic of a man's face.
It's entirely possible that some of the people in the ex-tombs living in Rome at that time were killed by this disease that shook the empire.
A laboratory technician wearing rubber gloves and a surgical mask tips a tooth out of a bag into a small bowl, then clamps it securely in a vise. Johannes heads up some stairs while the technician reaches for a small hacksaw.
In his lab in Germany, Johannes and his colleague Kirsten Boss are trying to extract DNA from the teeth samples taken from the tombs.
A variable speed drill.
I drilled out the pulp from inside the tooth, which is now powder. That powder now goes into a solution where the DNA gets released from the bone.
So our answer could be in that tube.
I hope so very much.
This process creates a mixture of billions of DNA molecules. It's a cocktail containing all manner of genetic material, but mostly soil microbes, plants, and fungi that were present in the tombs.
It's kind of like looking for the needle in the haystack. So you have billions of molecules that we get out of those teeth, and maybe just a few hundred come from the pathogen. So there's a lot of sorting, and then there's a lot of puzzling.
A sample's numbered.
To isolate any fragments of DNA left over from bacteria or viral pathogens, Johannes has adapted a technique known as DNA hybridization capture. He calls it fishing. On this glass slide are 100 short single strands of synthetic pathogen DNA. They include the genetic codes of everything from smallpox to measles, typhus to bubonic plague. The cocktail of DNA from each tooth is then added to the slide. The synthetic strands now act as bait to hook out any actual pathogen DNA from the solution.
Drawing on a whiteboard.
DNA has this double strand where you have the bases facing each other, yeah. And there's always this A facing with the T, and you have the G facing with the C.
And this creates the famous double helix. Everyone knows the kind of picture of DNA. Okay.
And just if the right sequence kind of matches the opposite sequence, those DNA fragments will actually bind and form the double bond. If they don't match, they will not come together. It's like a magnet, basically. It only kind of pulls the DNA together if the strands matches.
Gotcha. So only
pathogen DNA would bind here.
But Johannes is pushing this technique to its limits. It's never been used to fish for so many possible causes of ancient disease.
We have not just looked for a single pathogen, but we've actually looked for hundreds of them in parallel, because we don't know what has killed those people, and we don't know if it was one or several pathogens that were spreading in that population during that time.
Kirsten extracts some fluid with a needle.
And this is just the start of the process. Even if Johannes manages to isolate DNA from a disease-causing bacteria or virus, it could then take months or even years of computer analysis, comparing millions of genetic sequences to identify which specific pathogen was the cause of death.
Johannes studies data on a laptop.
He's got an incredibly difficult task ahead of him. But this technology, this science, represents the best chance we have of finding out what killed the people of the ex-tombs.
Back in Rome, while traffic rumbles above ground, Michael's down in the catacombs.
Back underground, the French team think they're getting closer to the possible identity of the people. They've been doing tests on a white powder that was found in the tombs.
Philippe says it was very odd. Right from the start, we found this whitish material covering the bodies. Our first reaction was to think it was lime. The use of lime is to prevent the bodies from putrefying and from disease spreading. We had some tests done, and when we got the results, it turned out that the material was actually plaster.
It's unusual to find plaster in traditional Roman burials. And this plaster contained further clues about how they were buried.
We can see particularly well a small imprint, which is in fact traces of fabric, which have become imprinted on the plaster. A sample in close-up.
The presence of plaster and fabric suggests these bodies may have been bound in an intricate shroud.
A computer overlay.
This would explain why the shoulders were compressed, hands resting on their pelvis, legs stretched out with ankles touching. And in among the skeletons and plaster, a second curious substance was discovered.
Dans certaines salles,
In certain chambers, in direct contact with the bones, we uncovered a very large quantity of very fine red flakes, rather like small crystals. In fact, the flakes turned out to be amber, red amber.
Amber was a very expensive material. It was used in burial sites to ensure safe passage to the afterlife. But it's rarely been found in this ground-up form, and never in this quantity. In all, several kilos were recovered from the tombs. One final piece in the puzzle was nearly overlooked altogether.
Philippe says, I was with Dominique. We were leaning over a skeleton when I saw this gold thread. I said to Dominique, have you lost a strand of hair? She answered, no, no. Well, in that case, I think we found a gold thread. That was at the beginning. The more we dug, the more gold threads we found. Sometimes heavily concentrated on the shoulders and collarbones, bands of gold threads. Sometimes just small fragments.
Could the people have been buried dressed in gold embroidered clothes?
Michael studies photos.
What began as just a mass of bones is beginning to come into focus a little. We've got a large number of individuals who are all carefully laid out one by the other. Mostly adults. And then there are all these strange finds, the white powders, the red powders. And then there's the fine gold thread, what they thought to be Dominique's hair.
We're getting a clear picture now of an elaborate and expensive burial ritual for what seemed to be some very wealthy and distinctive people.
At the Centre National de la Recherche Scientifique,
in Bordeaux, more clues are coming to light. One of the French team, Delphine Henry, has been studying remnants of the fabrics that were recovered from the tombs.
She writes up the results of her findings, then tells Michael there are different layers of fabric.
On a different couches de tissus, vous voyez très bien.
You can see very clearly we have coarse fabrics, finer fabrics, and some very fine fabrics in certain places. The very fine luxury fabrics were made by professional weavers. The coarser fabrics were probably made at home. She places a sample under a magnifying light.
Delphine believes she can even work out where the person who made the fabrics came from.
A thread is made by twisting the fibers, and traditionally this was done using a spindle. In the northern Mediterranean, the spindle is held at the top, and most people, being right-handed, give it a twist, which produces a thread called a Z-twist. Michael asks, so the Z-twist is European, and Delphine replies, we could refer to it as mainland Europe, and in the southern Mediterranean, they tended to hold the spindle at the bottom, and so produced an S-shaped twist. She draws a simple diagram. Michael asks, what do you think about this type of evidence? The material, the twist, the color? Delphine says, the coarser fabrics are often fabrics with an S-shaped twist, so more from the tradition of the southern Mediterranean. That could indicate the people who wove at home. The women were perhaps from an Egyptian tradition, or at least from the southern Mediterranean region. A nugget of gold-hued material under a magnifying glass.
Philippe believes this cultural connection with the southern Mediterranean can be narrowed further.
He carefully brushes a small bone, then says the practice of covering the corpse from head to foot in plaster does lend the body the appearance of a sort of mummy. That's quite an unusual custom. That was really a burial practice that came from northern Africa. probably in the region of Tunisia or Algeria, because we find a lot there. The fragments of a human skeleton laid out in the form of a body on a slab.
While the scientific analyses continue, there's one remaining historical avenue I want to explore. The ground directly above the ex-tombs was actually a site marked out for the burials of a very important group of people.
That's the entrance to our tombs over there, and the big structure behind me, that's the mausoleum of St. Helena, Emperor Constantine's mum. But ignore it entirely for the moment, because it was built in the early 4th century AD, way after the time we're interested in. During that time, end 1st century to mid 3rd century AD, despite what it now looks like, car park, football pitch, this place was actually a really important cemetery for the emperor's personal cavalry. Now, their name changes over time, but they're perhaps best known as the Equites Singulares Augusti.
A stone relief of helmeted horsemen carrying shields.
Equites Singulares Augusti is Latin for the emperor's chosen horsemen, a regiment founded in the 1st century AD. They are immortalized in reliefs on one of Rome's greatest landmarks, Trajan's Column, erected in AD 113.
A flight of steps leading up to a colonnade.
At the Museum of Roman Civilization, copies of the scenes are laid out so we can get a closer look.
One shows a horseman bearing a sheathed sword.
The reliefs celebrate Emperor Trajan's epic battles and ultimate victory over the Dacians, now modern-day Romania, in the early 2nd century AD.
Our Equites Singulares Augusti are shown no less than 7 times on this column, and that's more than any other individual battle unit. Here they are, heading off with the Emperor Trajan into battle. These guys really were the chosen ones to share in the Emperor's most successful military campaign. This is one of my favourite scenes. The Equites Singulares Augusti in full battle gear, their helmets, their shields, the chainmail jackets, on their horses, charging in behind their Emperor Trajan, who offers the horseman's salute, the open right hand. And they're coming to the rescue of the Roman troops that are being besieged over here by the Dacians. It really is the Emperor, his crack cavalry, coming to the rescue.
The Equites were the finest imperial horsemen. Most were foreigners, hand-picked as teenagers from across the empire. They were strong, and by many accounts, very handsome warriors. To be selected was a ticket to great wealth and high status. They protected successive emperors, both in Rome and abroad, for over 200 years, from the 1st to the 3rd century AD. But in AD 312, the cozy relationship between the Equites and the emperor came to an end.
Rome's ancient ruins.
The Western Empire was divided by civil war between two emperors, Maxentius and Constantine.
Busts of the feuding emperors.
Maxentius held Rome, but Constantine marched from the north to oust his rival. In a final showdown, the two sides faced each other at the Milvian Bridge, the entry point to Rome across the River Tiber.
A painting of the battle.
The Equites horsemen sided with Maxentius.
Soldiers and horses are shown tumbling from the bridge.
But Constantine was victorious.
Raffaella says Constantine was ruthless towards the Equites Singulares Augusti because they made a big mistake supporting Maxentius. She continues, they were destroyed and their regiment disbanded by Constantine.
Constantine even destroyed the Equites cemetery. All that remains are fragments of tombstones. Many now adorn the walls at the entrance to the catacomb of St. Marcellinus and St. Peter.
Dove c'era il loro cimitero,
their cemetery was replaced by the construction of a huge complex. Unfortunately today, only one significant monument remains.
Solo il mausoleo dove
the mausoleum where Helen, Constantine's mother, was buried. An ex-tomb skull in close-up.
The ex-tombs were in use around the same time and in the same location as the former site of the Equites Cemetery, which raises an intriguing possibility.
The dates of our ex-tomb bodies overlap with those of the Equites. It's unlikely that a space reserved for elites, as the Equites were, would have been used for burials of anyone completely unconnected with them.
Raffaella says it is possible these chambers might contain dead Equites Singulares Augusti.
The people in the ex-tombs were mostly young adults, a mixture of men and women. Now, we know from surviving tombstones that the Equites were often buried with their wives and slaves.
When they were in Rome, they lived here with their families. This would explain the high number of female bodies that were found in the tombs.
The Equites numbered 5,000 strong. They were foreigners, selected from various occupied territories across Central Europe and also from southern Spain and North Africa.
We've got connections in the funerary ritual to the southern Mediterranean, to North Africa, particularly to Tunisia and Algeria. The complex, elaborate and expensive funerary rituals with which they were buried not only mark them out also as rich, particularly that amber, but also fairly distinctive.
Written accounts also tell us they would dress in jackets embroidered with silver and gold thread. The Equites were wealthy, well-fed, and well-connected. But when overwhelmed by waves of mass death, it's conceivable that the Equites community may have converted pre-existing underground chambers, possibly disused water cisterns, into a mass burial site. It's only a theory, and we may never know for sure. But from all the evidence we have at the moment, it certainly seems plausible that the ex-tombs could be the last resting place for over 2,000 of these great horsemen and their families. Soldiers chosen to protect the Roman Emperor.
What I love about this investigation is the way that it's been able to put not just the flesh back on the bones, but to turn these skeletons back into real people. They came here to the Caput Mundi, the capital of the world, a kind of ancient Roman version of the American dream. And the irony is that it was also here in Rome that disease found its perfect breeding ground and ultimately killed them.